From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Amy Seek was a 23-year-old architecture student when she gave birth to her son Jonathan. Then she relinquished custody in an open adoption, which allowed her to stay in his life along with his adoptive parents. She calls the adoption her greatest accomplishment and deepest regret. This hour on Point, Confessions of a Birth Mother. You can join us on air or online. Have you participated in an adoption, open or closed, as the child, as the birth parent, or the adoptive parent? We're at onpointradio.org, on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from London is Amy Seek. She's author of the new book, God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. Amy, so nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Take us back to that day 15 years ago when you first realized that you were pregnant.
Well, it was a big surprise. I'd been dating my boyfriend for over a year, and we were very committed and very much in love. And I think had I met him years later, I would have, he would have been a really good partner for me. But at the time, I still had in my mind that there was a whole world ahead of me of both education and travel, and having a child just seemed like it would bring an end to all of those possibilities.
You write that when you found out you were pregnant, that you touched your stomach, felt the, quote, early seed of a lifelong grief. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you meant by that?
Once I decided that I was going to have the baby, I had a very beautiful sense of purpose in what was happening, but I also knew that it would come at great cost for me because I knew that I wasn't going to keep him. Or I was in the process still of deciding up until he was born, but our plan, our official plan, was that he was going to be adopted.
And what felt right to you about an open adoption?
I really didn't have any doubt about it when I was introduced to the idea. I went to Catholic Social Services to find out about adoption in general, and I didn't know that this existed, but it seemed so right immediately that there would be no reason to keep secrets about this, that the only way I would, all of the decisions I made about my child I wanted to make proudly, and open adoption allowed me to do that, to tell everyone, including him.
Tell us about the process of getting to know the couple who would adopt your son. Their names were Paula and Eric. You spent hours searching for them, for a family to adopt your baby, files stacked on your apartment floor. Talk about the process of that and how long it took.
Well, we began seriously in January, and we didn't find Paula and Eric until the end of March, which was the deadline that we had given ourselves to just decide on somebody. But I know now that even if we had gotten to the end of March and we hadn't found them, we wouldn't have just chosen our top choice of the remaining. It was so important that they be the right couple. But the process was very long and exhausting, and there were such highs of hope that a couple would be right, and then they would say something, and it was just the smallest things that would set off alarms in me, that this could not possibly be the people who would become my own family. They were very instinctive and primal, and I think that it was my maternal instincts that were on high alert. And so it was over 100 families. It was it was infinite, the list that we were getting from adoptive agencies, and they were mailing packages to us of dear birth mother letters is what they're called, and then online there was also infinite reserves of people, and so we definitely had the sense that we had our choice, and we took advantage of it to ask everyone every question we could think of.
You were 6 months pregnant when you drove to a restaurant in Indiana to meet Paula and Eric. I want you to tell us what happened there.
Well, the thing that was most striking about them was that they were in the middle of a conversation when we got there. And I can't tell you how powerfully I felt it with other couples that they were paralyzed in waiting for a child. And there were their nursery was set up, everything was ready for a child, but they couldn't move forward until the child came. And with Paula and Eric, it felt like they were living life, enjoying life, and if they could share their life with another child, they already had one, it would just benefit everyone, but they didn't need it. And so what they were talking about at the time was, should they get a second car? And they really didn't want to be people who had second cars. And I just loved the sort of normalcy of that conversation.
Right. And you write that they initially didn't stand out. You say that a lot of couples were trying to sell you on their stability. You talk about just now about having the nurseries ready. You write about, you know, couples telling you they had their college savings plans ready to go, but that there was an honesty about this couple and their future, which was frankly in flux at the time.
Yeah. They were in graduate school applying to PhD programs. They weren't sure what state they were going to live in. It turned out they were moving to a state that was anti-open adoption. There was so much. They were also already speaking to another birth mother. And they didn't stand out initially. They seemed articulate. They seemed like a solid couple. But what we were looking for was something that would be more like us in 10 years. And so they didn't have the things in common that we thought we wanted. And it wasn't until we met them and realized that the most important thing was actually trust, because they told us they don't need to give our child what we would give him because we would be in his life to give him those things.
Well, and what was their reaction to the suggestion of the open adoption, that you, in fact, would be involved in this child's life for years to come?
They wanted an open adoption. And everyone who writes a Dear Birth Mother letter is in fact, agreeing to some form of open adoption because your identities are being shared. But they had an open adoption with their older daughter. And they showed me to what extent they wanted an open adoption, because they not only accepted my expressions of wanting to move forward with them, but they told me that they thought that they would like to move forward with me. And I thought I'd somewhat had the feeling with other couples that if I decided I wanted them, they would definitely take me. But in this case, they were making their own evaluations, and they had decided that that they would like to have me in their life. They had stopped speaking with the other birth mother.
They wanted you in their life as much as you wanted them in their life, in your life. So you gave birth to Jonathan, and you write about this immediate connection that you felt with him, and you kept him with you longer than planned. Describe those days and then the moment that you gave him to Paula and Eric.
Well, this is something that I had been advised. I had very good advice from Catholic Social Services, but I was also reading everything I could about this moment and trying to prepare myself as much as I could. I was trying to feel it before I signed the papers. And some of the advice that I was given was to kind of numb myself before meeting him. And once he was born, I was supposed to not have a natural childbirth, to not keep him in my hospital room, definitely not breastfeed, and or take him home. And I had the strongest feeling once he was born that I needed to do all of those things. And the only way that I could possibly give him up would be to face all of those enormous things that I was letting go of. And I thought that if I couldn't give him up after doing all those things, then I really shouldn't give him up. So when he was born, I was completely indulging my motherhood. It was wonderful. And at the same time, trying to communicate with him to try to see what he thought and, you know, trying to get wisdom out of him that he was incapable of. But all the time, Paula and Eric were were staying close by and were coming to visit, and I would let them take him for periods of time. And they continually expressed to me that I had no obligation and that that they thought that I would be a great mother. And it wasn't, there was never a point where I felt absolutely definitive about it. It was just a moment that I really felt that he needed to begin his life. And I was, having made no preparations, I was just holding him in this indecision. And so they were ready to take him, and I decided that I definitely wanted them to have him.
Was there a moment that you thought maybe you weren't going to do this?
Oh, yes. Yes. Throughout my pregnancy, although I would never have admitted it, even entirely to myself, I was definitely, everyone was counting on it that I was going to let him go. My ex-boyfriend did not, who I deeply respected, he did not want to be an absent father. And so his being okay with adoption had to do with that he wanted the child to have two parents. So, but yes, until the moment that I signed the paper, I wasn't sure I was going to do it. And I had actually gone down to the agency several times to try to sign, and I just couldn't do it.
You write in the book that an open adoption is an awkward choreography. I'm offered a place at the table, but I'm not sure where to sit. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Amy Seek, the author of God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. In the 2011 Our America documentary series on the Oprah Winfrey Network, the mother of a teenager who gave up her child in an open adoption talked about the positive effect adoption had on her grandson, Teus's life, and the life of her teenage daughter.
He's got so much love around him, it reinforces her decision when she gets to see him. And I think she knows in her heart of hearts that it would not have been like that for Teo if she had just had him to herself.
And here's Will and Adrian Pfaffenberger talking with Indiana news station WTHR in April of this year about their efforts to adopt. Their adoption fell through when the birth mother changed her mind in the hospital. Here's Will.
There is a shift in your mind. There's a shift in your heart when you see your baby for the first time and you hold it. And that definitely happens. And it did happen for us. She was an adorable little girl, Perfect little girl. I don't remember any negative experience in those 2 days where we were her parents. Mm.
Amy Seek, you talk about the fact that you were on the fence, changing your mind back and forth throughout the pregnancy. Did the faces of Paula and Eric when that baby was born and they were holding that child, did that sway you at all, or was it still hard?
No, it didn't. The birth experience was so powerful that there was nobody in the world but me and my son, and I did not anticipate that kind of transformation. So even though I'd actually invited them to be part of the labor process, and Paula told me months before she said, I think we'll wait and see because you might change your mind about that. And in fact, when I went into labor, I was with them at a concert, and I wanted nothing more than to just have space and time to myself. And I let them come and meet him in the middle of the night after he was born, but it just didn't seem like their connection to him had any... It just was nothing compared to my connection to him. And I'm not saying I didn't still care about them. It's just that the world had changed completely.
So open adoptions mean many things in many places, from a letter and a photograph every year to regular visits. Talk about what your agreement was and is with Paula and Eric and Jonathan.
We agreed that we didn't want to have a contract about this. We agreed that if there was a contract, it could be broken, and the kind of trust and relationship that we wanted to have with each other would be sort of naturally evolving, like family. And there would be times when we were close and times when we, you know, had long spans of time between our visits. But so there was no need to pin it down for us, and there still hasn't been. We contact each other whenever we feel like it. It is just like family. And there's never been a time that I wanted to come see him that was any problem. And they've made valiant efforts to come at important times in my family's life to be part of things happening with my parents or my sister and brother.
And how do you describe, how do they describe Jonathan? How did they describe you to Jonathan and your relationship?
I, of course, don't know what they say when I'm not there, but I can tell when he sees me that they spend a lot of effort making me a simple subject and giving him the feeling that I'm someone he should love. I'm a good story, and he should be excited to see me. I have to assume that just because every time I see him, he's just beaming. And this throughout his life, from the early days when I thought maybe he won't even remember who I am, all the way to now when he's a teenager and he has his, you know, he's a teenager. So he's not always easy, but he's always so kind. Now he carries my bags and he pulls out chairs for me. So I have to assume that they've just spoken very highly of me throughout his life.
So you're the birth mother who is present, involved, but not in charge. What is that like?
The hardest thing is feeling like there's still a secret between us, because I won't speak about his adoption unless he brings it up, and he only has very, very easy questions about it. And so there's a lot of time that I just wish I could touch him. I just wish I could grab him the way that a mother does. So that, I think, those kinds of expressions of easy affection are what I most struggle with. So as a result, I feel kind of so constrained that I become exhausted. The constraint makes me exhausted. And when I leave him, I feel happy to be free of those. You know, I can tell anybody else in the world how I feel about them, but not him.
We have a lot of listeners who want to join us here. Let's go to Fran first in Springfield, Illinois. Hi, Fran. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I'm really anxious to read this book. I was adopted in 1975 through a closed adoption. But then about 7 or 8 years ago, I met my birth family. My parents actually married one another later. They were teens when I was surrendered. So I've kind of experienced the closed and open adoption. The one thing I really wanted to, like, that struck me was when she said she wanted to go into this proudly. That's wonderful to me. And that speaks to me why open adoption is so much better. Because my biological mom's experience, I believe, was filled with a lot of shame. And that's heartbreaking as an adult. I'm also a mother now, to have that shame surrounding it, like the proud nature of making an affirmative decision. I'm glad that you had that, I guess.
Fran, thank you so much for the call. Let me bring another voice into the conversation. In our studio here is Karen Chaney. Karen is Director of Adoption Services at Bright Futures Adoption Center, a program of the Robert F. Kennedy Children's Action Corps. She's also a lawyer, the parent of two children, ages 17 and 18, through open adoptions. Karen Chaney, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So that was such an interesting call from Fran about the shame that is often attached. What do you hear in this conversation with Amy Sieg?
I think that open adoption offers the opportunity, as Amy has pointed out, to enter into this in a proud way, a planful way, in a way that is thought out to benefit the child. And I think that Amy indeed is very, very brave and very articulate about it.
You see people making the kind of decisions that Amy made. You see this every day. Are most people seeking open adoptions today?
I think this is a question that depends on how much people know about open adoption. And Amy spoke well about being comfortable with it once she was introduced to the idea of open adoption. And so for many birth parents and adoptive parents, they don't know much about open adoption. And so they have to learn about it first. And part of what makes for a successful open adoption is the education component and making sure that people understand what it is and what it isn't, and they understand what role they can play in an open adoption. So many birth parents will come to our agency in particular because we focus on open adoption, and that is something they've read about online and they're very interested in. Other people require a little education to get there.
So Amy Seek's story has a happy ending. Everybody gets along, but that doesn't always happen.
No, that doesn't always happen. And I think that in open adoptions, first and foremost is what Amy talks about, which is trust. I would add to that respect. You need to trust and respect one another in order for it to be successful. You also need to share values and share holding that child at the center of everything that you do. Sometimes when those things don't happen, things don't work out quite as smoothly as Amy's situation.
So are adoptive parents ever nervous or worried? They must be, about allowing their child to have a relationship, an ongoing relationship, an open relationship with their birth parents.
Absolutely. I think there's, for adoptive parents, there's as much of an education or learning curve as there is for expectant parents or birth parents. And it's natural, I think, for them to feel fearful until they learn more about it and until they get to know and respect the person with whom they're going to have a relationship.
Let's get Joe in here from South Windsor, Connecticut. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Good day. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My first two children that I took in as foster children and later adopted knew their birth mother. We would have visits with them once they were old enough. We waited 11 years before we reunited them with their birth family and shared birthdays, et cetera, of the children within the birth family. The experts were saying this was the way to go, that this child will not attach to you except to the extent that you accept his or her biological family as part of your extended family. Mm-hmm. Most people who've given up a child for adoption are not as well educated, not as whole as your guests today. Most of them have lost their children and are of a certain level of functioning in the world, and as adoptive parents, it's very difficult for us to meet with the birth family, include them in our lives, but come from such different worlds. But we thought it was important.
Joe, thank you very much. I mean, is Amy's case the exception rather than the rule, Karen Cheney?
No, I don't think so. I think we're talking about different kinds of adoption. Amy's situation is what's called a voluntary placement, where Amy and the father of her baby made a decision together that this was what was in the child's best interest. They chose this for the child based on their life circumstances at the time. Quite different than this caller's situation, where the children were potentially removed because of abuse or neglect. And in those situations, in any kind of contemplation of open adoption, you really have to think about safety first for children, and also then what a child would benefit from in terms of that relationship. So I think there are different kinds of situations, and I think many of the private infant placements that are voluntary can turn out like Amy's situation, for sure, and some of the foster care situations as well can be very positive.
Amy Seek, take us back to your book. You write about the time that you were visiting when Jonathan was about 4 years old, I think, and he crawled into your arms. Recount that story and what happened, what he said.
You want me to read the passage from the book?
Or you can just tell it either way, whatever you feel most comfortable.
I think I'll read it.
Okay.
I'd always spend a lot of time playing with the kids in the living room, blocks and or hide-and-seek or anything we could come up with. I loved the moments Jonathan would inadvertently touch my skin, rolling a car over my arm or holding steady as he stepped over his toys. I'd keep still like he was a butterfly that didn't know it had landed on a person. I thought if I budged, it's me you're perched on. He might get scared and run away. His four fingertips on the top of my hand, the slight weight of his body against my upper arm. In those moments, I'd remember there was a place only we had been and questions only we shared. But I was careful not to look at him in a way that bridged back to that place, and I was careful to make sure no one saw me thinking about those things. He'd go back to his blocks, always intent on his task, and I'd quietly catch my breath, there on the futon or cross-legged on the floor across from him. Then one of those times when we were playing in the living room, he crawled into my arms and said, "Amy, pretend I'm your baby." He put his thumb into his mouth and waited, looking right up at me. I trembled, helpless and terrified, wondering whether he knew or what he was saying or what it all meant. But there was no time for questions. I held still and listened, making sure no one was nearby before I indulged his request, pulling him close and gazing down at him like he was my baby, my entire body shuddering at the chance to hold him like that for the first time since his adoption.
Hmm. I'm curious what your son's family thinks of this book and this very personal expression of what you've been through.
They have been supportive of my efforts to represent this story. I think it's difficult for them, but we had all spoken early on that we would write, all four of us together would write a book about this experience. And it turns out that it's difficult for them to know in detail the kind of intensity of the feelings that I felt. But they know they're there, and they've read it, and they've supported me moving forward with this writing.
Let's get Nancy in here from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome.
Thanks
go ahead.
For talking to me.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have two children that I adopted internationally, and they are 19, 22. And I have no clue about, well, my younger daughter was abandoned in Romania. We have no clue and no background and no history at all. And I just feel the kind of adoption that I did should be illegal. Mm. I feel like I bought my children. Mm. And I would hope that all of these would be stopped. And I don't think it's healthy for the kids not to have any history.
Nancy, thank you so much for the call. Karen Chaney.
Nancy, I appreciate your comment. I think the most important aspect of open adoption is about ongoing access to information for children. And when children are adopted in the type of situation that you experienced, they don't have that information either from the beginning or on any kind of ongoing basis. And it does leave holes in children, things that they can't know and probably won't be able to find out. There is some forward motion in the area of international adoption and openness, and in some countries, you are able to now go back and gather some information. And in fact, there is even some reunion going on in various countries where, you know, children are able to meet members of their birth families. So hopefully it will improve in the international setting. But I think you raise a very good point. It's very hard, particularly for the children, not to have that information, but also for the adoptive parents.
Amy Seek, how do you see this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that the part of the story that I tell is about my own sense of my origin, and there I was an accident, and my sister kind of tormented me with that information, even though in fact many children are accidents. But when I learned how much I was wanted, once my parents knew about me, it kind of changes the way that I see myself, and I think it's very important for my son to know how much he was loved. This decision had nothing to do with whether we loved him and the life that we wanted him to have.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Amy Seek, the author of God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother, and Karen Chaney, an adoption expert and parent of two children adopted through open adoptions. In the 2007 movie Juno, Juno's friend Leah, played by Olivia Thirlby, helps Juno, played by Ellen Page, consider prospective parents in the penny saver section of the newspaper.
I don't want to give the baby to a family that describes themselves as wholesome.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I just want something a little more edgier.
Okay, what did you have in mind exactly?
I was thinking more like graphic designer, mid-30s, you know, with a cool Asian girlfriend who, like, dresses awesome and rocks out on the bass guitar. But I don't want to be too particular.
Amy Seek, your son is growing older now. He's almost 15. I'm curious how your relationship with him has changed as he's grown.
Well, I think that it's only changed in as much as he's become somebody that now I have conversations. We debate politics and philosophy now as opposed to playing with Legos. So it's not, there's no deep way in which things have changed. And over the years, he's asked a few questions about his adoption. But I sort of wanted to say that before, that it's amazing how easily those questions are answered, and how they seem to, you know, having access to me allows it all to seem very simple.
Karen Chaney, you talk about the calculus does change when kids grow older and the adults have to shift sort of their relationship with each other.
Yeah, I think that initially the relationship is held by the adoptive parents and the birth parents together as adults, and it's held sort of in trust for the children. And as, you know, children are at that toddling stage and they're young and they're playing with Legos, they aren't going to be directing the relationship as much. But as they grow into their teen years, they may be communicating directly with their birth family in some way, on Facebook or through texting or on the phone or in person. They may be asking their parents, you know, can we have a visit now, and be much more directive of the process for themselves. And I think it sounds, Amy, like this has happened in a very natural, flowing way in your situation because you've been consistently and actively involved in your son's life. So it may not feel like a drastic change. But I think in some cases, it can shift things, particularly if a child wants something different than their adoptive parents want, or something different than their birth parents want out of that relationship.
Let's get Mary in here from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Sure.
I have an open adoption. My daughter's 13. And like your author, I established quite a trust and a great rapport with the adoptive parents over these 13 years. All of our families get together, and we all, you know, just love my daughter. And we love her other adoptive siblings. And I just got a letter in the mail saying, your unhappiness over a lack of a warm and intimate relationship with your daughter feels like it grows every year. We are calling for a one-year separation. No correspondence, emails, texts, no phone messages, no presence at public events like baseball, church, or school.
And that's from the adoptive parents, Mary?
Yep. And you talk about open adoption, and it, you know, it's a beautiful thing, and it is, until you get a letter like this. And then I'm trying to find my papers to see if I have any legal recourse. Probably, I'm going to guess I don't. But I'm just floored that I am such a nice person. And yes, I wish I could hug her. I wish I could be more affectionate with her. But to cut me off, me and my family, who, I mean, my dad is like just beside himself that we cannot contact them for a year.
And that this has happened after the last 13 years. Mary, thank you so much. I appreciate the call, and I wish you the best. Karen Chaney, can states enforce agreements made between a couple and a birth parent? I mean, what's the law here?
Yeah, Mary, I'm sorry for your situation. It sounds like it was pretty out of the blue for you. Here in Massachusetts, every state is different, but here in Massachusetts, there is a statute that permits a formal post-adoption contact agreement that's enforceable in the probate court if it's entered into between the birth and adoptive parents at the time, you know, the adoption is initially happening and is filed with the court at the time of the legal finalization of the adoption. If you don't have a contract like that, it is very hard to enforce. There are alternatives, however, and I think, you know, Mary, this is a kind of situation where clinical intervention or mediation might be helpful in a sense of maybe talking back with your agency or with someone who's an expert in this field to help you sort things out with those adoptive parents.
Mary, thank you. Here's John from Dayton, Ohio. Hi, John. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Yes.
My situation is a little bit different. I was born during the closed adoption era in 54, and I was adopted at 5 days old. But I was told very early about my adoption. My adopted mother was very loving, and I think she provided me with an emotionally stable environment, which I think helped me later on in life when I did meet my my birth mother. Mm. One of the things that's very important about open adoption versus closed adoption is that all parties have some emotional stability. My birth mother was not emotionally stable, and when I did meet her when I was 40 years old, I learned that she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. She had been in and out of various institutes while I was growing up, and unbeknownst to me, of course. After learning that, I realized that she didn't fit my perception of who I had imagined my mother to be. Mm. And that became kind of difficult for me to accept. Sometimes I think an open adoption would help a child realize, you know, who his parents are. And I could see that being a very positive matter. But on the other hand, both parties need to be emotionally stable.
John, thank you for bringing up this important point. Karen Chaney.
This is an excellent point, John. The success of an open adoption is quite dependent on everybody's ability to hold the child's best interest at the center, as I've said previously. And in order to do that, everybody does have to have the ability to control their own self and their own emotions and feelings around all of this. So that is crucially important. I think the other thing you raise is the importance of truth for children. Part of the benefit of open adoption is having access to the information so that adoptive parents and birth parents can be fully truthful with children. And children can understand if a parent has a mental health issue if they are taught about that. And then they can be taught what to expect. They may not have in-person contact if the person with the emotional instability isn't able to do so. But the truth will help the child have a more accurate picture of who the birth parent is in this particular case.
We talk about birth mothers a lot. Karen Chaney, what about birth fathers?
Birth fathers are a huge part of this process. They're just as important as birth mothers, for sure. In open adoptions, again, laws vary state to state, but in a state like Massachusetts, birth fathers have very similar rights to birth mothers and can also have their own post-adoption contact agreement if they would like, or their own relationship with the adoptive family. And it's very nice if birth mothers and fathers are working together and they're visiting with the child together. But if that relationship between birth mom and birth dad isn't particularly stable together, they can certainly have independent relationships and the child can have the benefit of knowing both of their parents.
Amy Seek, does your son's birth father have contact with him?
Yes. He's had kind of the same ongoing relationship since our son's birth. And now they live pretty close together. And so I think it's a bit easier for him even than me to see him.
You write about your son, the fact that he's thriving in a happy home. Has he ever asked you about the circumstances of his adoption?
He's only asked me really easy questions that how long was it after I was born that they came? And I answer that, and he always becomes interested in another subject pretty quickly after asking me a question like that.
And birth
and
mother?
There was,
oh, sorry, go ahead, please.
Sorry. There was sometime recently that he texted me a screenshot of a music purchase he had just made of the song that was playing at the concert that when I was when I went into labor with him. And I wasn't sure if it was coincidence that he was telling me he had just bought this song or if he knew the significance. And I asked him,
And if he knew the significance of that song to me, and he said, yeah, that's what was playing when I was getting ready to be born. And I contacted his mother about it, and she said, well, I thought it was a story he should know. And because that song made her think so much of him, so she wanted him to have knowledge of it. And so I think he gets pieces of the story and curiosity. He only finds it necessary to ask questions every now and then.
Let's get Tamara in here from Teton, Idaho. Tamara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Okay, so I'm a birth parent as well. I placed Justin in May of 1996, and then we were reunited when he was 17, 2.5 years ago. And his family have just kind of adopted me and my family as an extension of their own, just without hesitation, open arms. It's been astonishing to me. It's been so beautiful. And I think the way that they view it is like, hey, anyone who's invested in our son's success, get in here. We're all on Team Justin. And for me, reunion has been one of the hardest things I've done since placement. But like placement, it was right because it was what was best for him. And reunion has been the same because his life hasn't been a fairy tale. There have been things that couldn't have been predicted or prevented. And he's very much kind of reeling from those things now, which is really difficult for me because when you place for adoption, you think they're going to have a perfect life. However, it's been the best thing for him. I think it couldn't, you know, I think the timing was miraculous. The way I even found them was miraculous. And I think it's just the best thing for everyone involved, though it's not easy. And we have a great relationship. We're homies. We're confidants. But I really identified with what Amy said about just feeling like I want to hold my baby. You know, I just want to I want to lick him like a mama cat. You know, like I just want to be all over him. And there's that tension, that awkwardness of not feeling like I'm free to do that. But there's a learning curve, absolutely, and I think it would have been better for everyone involved if we'd had an open adoption from the beginning. I can see how that would have helped him. The loss will always be a loss, but I'm so grateful for what we have now, and I'm grateful to his family for not being territorial, not being insecure, and not feeling threatened, knowing that their role exists and their role is stable and firm despite who else loves him. Mm. You know, it's wonderful.
Tomorrow, thank you. Amy Seek, would you add anything?
Well, I would say I agree that there's really no doubt who his parents are when we go and visit. It doesn't feel like we're stepping on each other's toes. In the beginning, when they're in the process of still kind of taking ownership of him, which they call entitlement, this process that they need to go through to feel like they deserve to have him and they are free to love him, you kind of feel like you have to step back and be very careful about anything that you might do because that love is so overwhelming when they're in an infant and when you actually can grab them and squeeze them and hold them. But over time, it's just they have become his parents. And if I tried to go and take him away, he would just look at me very confused. I'm no threat.
Karen Chaney, we've heard from Amy Seek, the birth mother. You're here as an expert on open adoptions. You've also been part of an open adoption as the adoptive mother. Talk about that experience for you personally, given what you do for a living, and how that's changed you.
Well, I think that first off, you know, I adopted my children before I became an adoption professional. So my initial experience was one that evolved very much like what Amy's talking about. You know, when you grow up in a family, you have a model typically of what a parent is. But you don't generally have a model of what a birth parent is or what an adoptive parent is. You know, we don't know what those roles are. We have to figure them out. And as a new adoptive mother, I didn't know what my role either was, but I thought that if I could be compassionate and I could get to know and enjoy my children's birth parents, that our relationship would evolve in a natural course to be a pleasant and rewarding one for everyone. There are definitely ups and downs, and my kids' birth parents are all, as individuals, very different people. I think it's changed me into a more compassionate and thoughtful person, and I absolutely have a better understanding of loss on many levels than I did before I knew them as well as I do.
Amy Sieg, one of the exercises that you were given that you write about in adoption counseling was to envision the hour immediately after the adoption. And I'm curious, in this moment, as we wrap up here, what did you see? And in hindsight, how does it look?
I'm sorry.
So when you were giving up this baby, you were supposed to...
What did I see?
Yes. What did you see happening in the years?
They wanted me to walk through all of the moments immediately after, like driving home from signing, cleaning up my house. And in my case, I thought, well, I'll register for classes because I'll be starting classes next semester. And I could write those things out to satisfy the counselor. But as far as I was concerned, my life was now in North Carolina. I couldn't envision anything for myself. I could only envision what his life would be.
And all these years later, how does that moment look to you?
Well, I'm so grateful for how it worked out. I could have never dreamed that it would begin to feel natural and that I would have the opportunity to, so many opportunities to love him and be loved by him and his family.
My thanks to both of you for a really wonderful hour. Karen Chaney, Director of Adoption Services at Bright Futures Adoption Center. It's a program of the Robert F. Kennedy Children's Action Corps. Karen, great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Amy Sieg, the author of the memoir God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. Thanks so much for your honesty. Amy, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.